Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Will Falk. He's a biophilic writer and lawyer. The natural world speaks, and Will's work is how he listens. He believes the intensifying destruction of the natural world is the most pressing issue confronting us today. His first book is How Dams Fall, Stories the Colorado River Told Me. It's an excellent book. You can follow Will's work at willfalk.org. You can follow his writing about the Ohio River at theohioriverspeaks.org. This writing about the river will, when he finishes it, become his next book. You can support his efforts at Help to Amplify the Ohio River's Voice. So first off, Will, thank you for all of your great work over the years. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Derek. I'm always really excited to talk to you.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you, too. So tell us about the Ohio River. Just start at the beginning, I guess.
Yeah, the Ohio River is a magnificent being who has a tremendous history with humans in particular. And she is someone who in the last couple centuries has been really abused by humans. She's gotten a bad rap, so to speak, due to industrial pollution, especially in the last 100 years or so. And she's also the river that I was born along in Evansville, Indiana, some almost 34 years ago. So I like to say that there's no being besides my mother and father who's more responsible for my life than the Ohio River, because I spent the first 10 years of my life drinking primarily Ohio River water. She's commonly thought to begin in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the confluence of the Allegheny and Monongahela rivers. This is kind of misleading because if you were actually going to follow the Ohio River up the Allegheny, especially, you would see that it's probably her more physical headwaters are located in Potter County, Pennsylvania, just a few miles from a little town called Countersport, Pennsylvania. And it's actually the Seneca people of the Haudenosaunee Iroquois Confederacy named her Ohio, which is Seneca for beautiful river, and the word Ohio is an anglicized version of that word. It seems that most people upon first encountering the Ohio River called her the beautiful river. The French called her, I believe it was La Belle Rivière when they first arrived in the area. And Thomas Jefferson famously wrote that the Ohio River is the most beautiful river in the United States.
Why?
Right now.
What's so beautiful about it?
The reason that the Ohio River is so beautiful is she starts in these... She starts on the western side of the Appalachian Mountains, which are the oldest mountains in the world, and also create these really beautiful rounded hills that are heavily forested and naturally were heavily forested with tall white pines and hemlocks, and the first European settlers in the area said you could drive a oxen cart across the state of Pennsylvania and through the Ohio River basin and never once have to go around a tree because the tree branches, the trees were so tall that the pines tree branches were 20 and 30 feet up in the air. So there was all this room to move around. But then Pennsylvania is also where the headwaters of the Ohio River are, is also a place that glaciers moved across in the last ice age, leaving tons of little clear little stony streams that are very melodic and are very musical and in fact are still because northwestern Pennsylvania is not very populated, they're still relatively clean streams, and these streams are what gather to form the Ohio River. The river is also, there's only really one, traditionally there was only really one difficult to navigate spot, and that is a place near Louisville, Kentucky. And so you could float the Ohio River for hundreds of miles without ever needing to get out of your boat. For traditional humans, that meant that there was trading along the Ohio River from her headwaters all the way down to the Mississippi, and in fact, down the Mississippi into the Gulf. Those are the main reasons that I think that they named the Ohio River the Beautiful River. She also originally supported all kinds of life. There's, I believe, something like 165 native fish that have lived in the Ohio River. It's also, interestingly, one of the best freshwater mussel habitats in the world. And there were, I think, about 50 native freshwater mussel species on the Ohio River originally. There are now 11 or so of those went extinct, and there's something like 35 native mussels that are still doing pretty well on the Ohio River, but there are five endangered species. I do want to name those species because one of my favorite things about these native mussels is the really funny names or really interesting names that have been given to them over time. But the five endangered mussel species that are really struggling and that really need protection on the Ohio River are named the pink mucket, the orangefoot pimpleback, the fat pocketbook, club shell, and fan shell. So those are the reasons why the Ohio River was named the Beautiful River. I was just this weekend floating a part of the what's called the Middle Allegheny, which is below the Kenzu Dam. I floated from a little place called the Buckaloons Recreation Area down through this federally protected island wilderness area. And I flowed past a place called Thompson's Island, which still has some of the last remaining old growth forests in Pennsylvania. The river protected those islands from the loggers. It made it inaccessible for the loggers to get on there and cut down the trees. But there were carbon dated remains found on Thompson's Island that went back 12,000 years. And of course, the Seneca have said that they've lived there for time immemorial. So human beings have lived and lived well with the Ohio River for over 12,000 years. As Europeans came into the area, the Ohio River figured prominently in colonial history. So it was actually the claims over the Ohio River were a major part that France and Great Britain went to war in what in Europe is called the Seven Years' War and what we call the French and Indian War, which was a seven-year war, a war that many historians have called the first truly world war because there was fighting as far away as India and in North America. But the Ohio River was so desired by those colonial powers that she prompted this war. She also formed part of the original Mason-Dixon line. So she separated slave states from free states in the pre-Civil War United States. And she was also a landmark in the Underground Railroad when African Americans were using the Underground Railroad and running away from slavery. When they crossed the Ohio River, they were at least in free states, and there was much more friendly people in the North that helped them either get to Canada or help them, hide them throughout the northern states. I also read several stories of about how there were instances where slave patrols would try to cross the Ohio River while chasing someone running from slavery. And people that lived on the northern side of the Ohio River would meet those slave patrols with their own weapons. And there was numerous stories of people shooting across the Ohio River at the slave patrols to tell them to go away. So the Ohio River has been this symbol of freedom in American history. She also unfortunately helped to power the great industrial boom, especially steel and iron production in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So one of the reasons that the Ohio River is the most polluted river in the nation today is because she had the ill fortune of being located next to lots of coal mining, lots of iron ore mining in eastern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, West Virginia. And she also happened to be lined with these beautiful hardwood and beautiful tall forests. That steel production especially has caused her to be the most polluted river in the United States. Things really, I guess, hit the pollution at least was in its most obvious form in the 1950s. There has been efforts to slow what is called point source pollution. Point source pollution in a river is pollution that it comes directly from a pipe, directly from manufacturing and factories that pump water right into the Ohio River. And efforts through the 60s and 70s to shut down, especially point source pollution, led to the Ohio River's water at least getting back to what government agencies call drinkable after heavy treating. The bad news is those efforts seem to have leveled off in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s, so that there's been a lot of problems making any advances in cleaning up the Ohio River's water. A major part of this is, despite the fact that point source pollution has been slowed, non-point source pollution, which is things like agricultural runoff and just simple pollution from cities, oil from cars that wash into drains that wash into the Ohio River, are still heavily polluting the Ohio River. So she brings together, I think, one of the things that is so fascinating to me about the Ohio River is every problem that exists, it seemed like, in industrial societies, in industrial civilization, are reflected in the Ohio River. And if we start with wanting to protect the Ohio River, and if we were going to say, we want to return the Ohio River to her natural state, we would have to confront just about every problem with civilization imaginable, from agriculture to manufacturing to huge concentrations of human populations in cities such as Pittsburgh and Cincinnati and Louisville. So I think she provides an opportunity to anyone that cares, and anyone that does want to heal the natural world, to really understand how all those problems come together. She could really be a leader in showing us what we have to do to return human cultures to some semblance of sanity.
Thank you for that. And I want to back up just a little bit. And you mentioned agricultural runoff, and I have in front of me a map showing the Ohio River drainage, and it drains western Pennsylvania, almost all of West Virginia, a little bit of Virginia, almost all of Kentucky, almost all of Ohio, almost all of Indiana, and southeastern Illinois. And the point being, that's a lot of agricultural land, which implies a lot of agricultural runoff. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, so that's kind of the eastern edge of what is traditionally thought of as the American breadbasket. So there's lots of grain production in the area. There's lots of corn production in the area. There's lots of soy production in the area now. But one of the I guess horrible things about really powerful parts of the global water system, so really powerful river basins like the Ohio River Basin, is all that water. Water is life, and agriculture finds a way to abuse that water. Agriculture is drawn to river valleys and river basins like the Ohio River. Unfortunately, agriculture also strips the land of forests, strips the land of soil. That's when the forests are cut to clear land for agriculture. Soil runs into the river, and one of the major problems in the Ohio River Basin is dredging to try and move that soil away from the river's flow. This was one of the very first big agricultural areas in the United States. It was one of the very first places where agriculture really took hold in the early settlement of the United States by Europeans. And therefore, the Ohio River has suffered from all the abuses that agriculture wreaks on rivers. This is also tied to the problems in the Gulf of Mexico. So the Ohio River drains all the areas that you just said, and then the Mississippi is draining Minnesota, Iowa, Kansas, other heavily agricultural areas. The Missouri River is also draining all that area. And so things that happen in Pennsylvania, agricultural pollution that happens in Pennsylvania travels all the way from Pennsylvania down to New Orleans, essentially down to the Gulf of Mexico. And it's really a classic example of something that's said all the time. We all live downstream. Well, the Ohio River basin really shows us how that is true. Agriculture is one a huge problem, but the fracking boom in western Pennsylvania is another huge problem. So in the last 15 years or so, Pennsylvania opened itself up to fracking, and Fracking uses a tremendous amount of water. So one of the reasons why fracking seems so good to people in Pennsylvania, to the gas industry, to the oil industry, is they had all that water, and fracking is a hugely water intensive process. It also creates a lot of waste. It creates a lot of especially radioactive waste. So water is pulled out of the Ohio River Basin and used to frack oil. And then that wastewater, radioactive wastewater, is created, which then has to be stored somewhere. And of course, industry doesn't ever do a great job of storing things like radioactive wastewater. So now there's radioactive wastewater draining into the Ohio River basins, which means that wastewater is also flowing all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and endangering countless non-humans and millions of humans that live in the Ohio River and Mississippi River basins.
So before we move on to what you're doing with the river and also efforts to clean it up, I want to back up again. And you've talked about other problems, but you haven't really mentioned dams. Are dams a big issue on the Ohio, or are dams not such a huge issue?
Yeah, so the dams on the Ohio River are not perhaps, I hate to say relatively that dams on the Ohio River are not as bad as the infamous dams on, say, the Columbia River. But the dams on the Ohio River are mainly used to create locks to help barges move across the river. The dams are bad for migrating fish populations. They also enable most of the barge traffic on the Ohio River is moving oil products, gas, oil, other fossil fuel things. And so the dams enable that to happen. But the main problem with dams on the Ohio River are the way that they interrupt these migrating fish populations. I just got finished writing about and learning about the Kinzu Dam, which is a dam on the New York-Pennsylvania border that was completed in 1965, and it was. The justification for it was to provide flood control to Pittsburgh. In the 30s and 40s, Pittsburgh suffered from or experienced several large and damaging floods, and there was a huge push by industry in Pittsburgh to make sure that didn't happen again. So conveniently, the best place for a dam that the Army Corps of Engineers picked happened to be Seneca land, and happened to be land that was guaranteed to a famous Seneca war chief, a man named Corn Planter. Corn Planter was a fierce resistance fighter, especially during the American Revolution. He fought against the Americans, through his fighting, he was able to negotiate with George Washington himself for this land on the New York-Pennsylvania border. Well, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers decided that's where they wanted to place the dam, and of course, submerged dozens of square miles of Seneca land that had been promised to them forever by the United States government. And hundreds of Seneca people were forcibly removed by the John F. Kennedy administration of all presidents. Dams in the Ohio River Basin, they facilitate fossil fuel transportation, fossil fuel production, the fossil fuel industry. They create these in between the locks. They create what are basically pools of water. The Ohio River in between these dams I believe that there are 18 dams on the Ohio River from Pittsburgh to about Cairo, Illinois, where she arrives at the Mississippi River. And I recently read something that described the Ohio River not as a river, but as a series of 18 pools. And those pools, when the water's not moving, that affects the underwater ecology, which affects all the beings that live there, especially the freshwater mussels, which I mentioned the five that are horribly endangered. But one reason that they're horribly endangered is those series of dams and locks. So you have those problems, but then a dam like the Kinzu Dam also incorporates all the horrible aspects of the colonization of traditional peoples in the area, and really again represents the worst of settler colonialism in the United States.
So, also, I wanted to ask you before we go on, I want to ask a couple questions about fish. And I have no idea who are the main fish on the Ohio, if it's types of bass or types of. I have no idea. And so, two questions. One is, who are some of the primary fish? And second, including some big fish. And second, you mentioned migrations, and it blew me away to learn that the largest animal migration on the planet is the Mekong River catfish, their migration. That's the biggest animal migration on the planet, bigger than the Serengeti, bigger than the buffalo, if you go by weight. And it's, I presume that there are no anadromous fish who go all the way from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to Pennsylvania, I presume. But can you talk about A, fish, and B, migrations?
Yeah, some of the fish species, some of the big ones are some of the most famous fish in America. I mean, there's striped and black bass on the Ohio River. There are walleye on the Ohio River. There are sauger, pike, catfish are a major species on the Ohio River. There's also this really cool fish called a paddlefish, which sometimes you can see floating on the surface, and it kind of looks like this little freshwater shark. And it's got kind of a flat body, and it just kind of motors along the top of the river, cleaning the river. There are all kinds of darters, which are these small, the kind of most people might just assume they're just minnows. But I haven't got a chance to go snorkeling, which is something that I've heard I have to do. But I recently bought a book describing the fish on the Ohio River, and I was blown away by the colors in especially these darters. So they're when you see the Ohio River Basin's water, it's often kind of brown and muddy. The water isn't always as clear. It's the streams that run off the hills are clear, but in the actual river, it can be pretty muddy and dark. But I saw pictures of this darter in particular called a candy darter, which has all these pinks and blues and yellows. And when I opened up the book, I thought that I bought the wrong book. I thought that I bought a book that was showing me tropical fish. But there's actually all these beautiful, colorful, tropical-looking fish that live in the Ohio River. There are trout, especially in the upper Ohio River Basin. Pennsylvania, northwestern Pennsylvania, is some of the best brook trout and rainbow trout waters in North America. In terms of the migration, I don't know as much about those fish migrations. It's something I have been traveling with the Ohio River for about 8 weeks now. Things are going more slowly than I thought, primarily because I'm finding so much to write about all the time. And I've only done the first third of the Allegheny, which is about the first third of the first third of the Ohio River. So I don't know as much about fish migration, but it's something that I really want to learn about. But what I do know about fish on the Ohio River is there's about 160 fish species. There's the famous fish that are called the sport fish, like black bass and walleye and northern pike and catfish. But then there's also all these little darters and suckers and perch that if you didn't know better, you might think like I did, were some tropical fish and not fish that lived in the northern states of the United States.
And so before we go to what you're doing on the river, how big are some of the biggest fish on the Ohio? Like the biggest catfish or the biggest paddlefish or whoever's the biggest fish?
Yeah, they're catfish get really big, and I've seen pictures and heard stories and read about catfish being 200 and 300 pounds, really big catfish that can live in deep waters and get huge. There's another famous fish, a muskie, muskellunge. Is a big predator fish I've heard described as a freshwater shark. The muskies can be 55, 60, 65 inches, and are sometimes seen. In fact, I was talking with a man who is a fish ecologist a couple weeks ago, and he told me a story about. He was watching. He knew there's this musky area on the Allegheny, on the middle Allegheny, where he knew there were musky, and he knew that they would jump sometimes. But what he started to see was there were these little swallows, birds that were swooping low, chasing insects over the water, and he said he saw in a half an hour 3 or 4 times muskie leap out of the middle Allegheny and eat sparrows on the fly, and he said this was incredible because these muskie had to be watching from a couple feet underneath the water, and swallows are not very big birds, and they move really fast. And the muskies were able to see those swallow and leap out and catch them in midair. Yeah, muskies are one of the famous predator fishes on the Ohio River.
And the calculations involved in terms of velocity, I mean, you have to predict. That's as you said, they're fast, and they also turn on a dime, as it were. And so that's a pretty extraordinary calculation for the muskie to be able to do that.
Right.
So actually, I apologize because I want to ask one more question about nature before we go to what you're doing, and that's
Absolutely.
You haven't talked at all, and this is a shot in the dark. You haven't talked at all about insects. Are there, and of course, insects in riparian zones and insects along rivers are often a big deal. Is there anything you want to say about insects and the Ohio?
I don't, again, I haven't learned as much about insects yet. I think that what I'm likely to find is that the Ohio River drainage basin, especially the riparian zones like you're talking about, are great habitat for migratory insects, especially the pollinators. bees and butterflies and the like. And again, agriculture wipes those plants out, which then wipes out the insects. Similarly, the fertilizers and other chemicals that are put on fields damage insect populations. I would imagine that that's what I'm going to find is that insect populations are struggling on the Ohio River. That kind of triggers something I read. There's a famous report from 2018 called the Living Planet Index. This is the people that calculated that we've lost 60% of vertebrate species around the world since 1970. Well, they found that we've lost 83% of freshwater vertebrate species since 1970, so even more. I would imagine that part of that is insect populations collapsing. Anytime you have that sort of collapse, then in a certain type of species or vertebrates and invertebrates, that those two things usually go hand in hand.
Well, one reason I asked is because insects are incredibly important for bird species, obviously, and also they're really important for fish because of a lot of insects go through an underwater larval stage, or at least some insects go through an underwater baby stage where they become food for all sorts of other beings who live down there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about what you're doing. What are you doing and why and how and what's going on?
So I'm in well, so I'm traveling with the Ohio River. I'm traveling with the Ohio River, trying to write a book called The Ohio River Speaks. I'm also trying to connect communities throughout the Ohio River Basin, who are fighting to protect the Ohio River. I found that there are a lot of people doing a lot of stuff for the Ohio River, but sometimes they are only working on one issue and they don't understand what's happening upstream or downstream. And so I want to connect people and help them see the entirety of the Ohio River Basin. I originally planned to start this in mid-March, but with the COVID-19 pandemic and the shelter-in-place orders, I drove out to Cowdersport, Pennsylvania, and was lucky to have a place to shelter in place. So I started traveling in earnest in early June. And the basic premise of the book is that the Ohio River speaks. And that if I ask her to help me understand what's going on, if I ask her for lessons, if I ask her what she needs, that she'll tell me if she wants to. Sometimes she doesn't want to. So I am trying to ask two basic questions in as many places as I can along the Ohio River. And those two questions are, who are you and what do you need? I think one major impetus for this project is I've found even amongst environmental activists that so many activists are so involved in kind of abstract campaigns that are designed to to get better regulations for water quality in the Ohio River Basin, get better regulations against the fracking industry, or to gain a few small concessions from the government to maybe protect a few acres of the Ohio River Basin. But I don't find that most humans have the proper sense of urgency about what's going on with the planet and with the Ohio River in particular. And I think one reason for that is we don't see beings like the Ohio River as our kin, as our literal family members. And if we knew that someone was pumping radioactive waste into our mother, we would act in a certain way. We would use our bodies to defend our mother. So I want to write in a way that encourages people to see the Ohio River as a family member, to see the Ohio River as a living being who can speak with us, who gives us life, and then to see the persistent violence that is being wreaked on the Ohio River, and then to act appropriately, to act appropriately. I've been for the last few years, I've been involved in rights of nature work. I'm a lawyer too, and I started to get really frustrated with rights of nature because I started to realize that it's going to take decades to convince governments or courts to give beings like the Ohio River rights. I mean, it took decades, it took hundreds of years in a civil war to give African Americans rights in this country. And African Americans are human beings. So when I look at the rights of nature movement, I just get frustrated that it's going to take a really long time. And I don't think that beings like the Ohio River have a long time, especially when every day that passes, more and more poisons are pumped into her, more and more destruction happens to her. And I started to ask, why aren't people doing more? And like I just said, I think it's because people don't understand the reality. They don't feel the destruction in their hearts. And you know, I don't want to suggest that me writing a book is going to catalyze a serious resistance movement, but I'm trying to get people to think of non-humans, of the natural world, as beings that we have to act urgently, to protect.
Well, thank you for all that. I love what you just said. And I want to go back to something you said early on in that little discussion where you said you ask the river. And what does that mean? What does that look like? I mean, does that mean sitting by the river and physically saying? Does it mean and how you said sometimes the river does answer, and how does the river answer?
Yeah, so I do go to the river and try and spend as much time as close to the river or in the river or on the river as I can. And I do ask out loud. One of the very first things I did was I went to the headwaters of the Allegheny, the headwaters of Ohio, the Ohio River. And I found the very last, well, or the very first spring where the Ohio River bubbles up from the ground in this hollow in Potter County, Pennsylvania. And I actually had kind of written out an introduction, and I just started telling the Ohio River about myself, and I told her what I was trying to do, and I asked her what she thought people needed to know, what I needed to know, and what she wanted me to say and write about her. So then how do I hear what her response is? Sometimes the response is obvious. So just recently, just on Saturday, actually, 3 days ago, I was kind of overwhelmed with topics to write about the Ohio River, everything from fracking to the history of logging in the region to the fur trade that destroyed beaver populations in the Ohio River Basin. And there's all these current events, the pandemic. How does the pandemic affect the river or affect the way we view the natural world? And I couldn't really pick one thing, and my mind was really jumbled up, and I got caught in kind of a torrential downpour, and in my kayak, and I was sitting there on the river, listening to the rain fall on the river's face, listening to the rain fall on the trees, on the forests, on the riverbanks. And the sound of the rain hitting the river made this sound that sounded like someone saying shh or hush. And I realized that, in that moment, my mind was really quiet, and I realized what I had to write about. So the Ohio River was telling me to quiet my mind in a very direct way. Other times, my attention will be drawn to something. I saw the Seneca Nation flag flying beneath the American flag near the Kenzie Dam, and realized I wanted to learn the history of how the Seneca were colonized and subjugated. And that took me down this whole path of learning about the history of settler militias in the Ohio River Basin, the massacres that happened so that Europeans could control the Ohio River. And so sometimes I'll be reading a book about that history, and a detail will hit me, and I often recognize the Ohio River drew me to that detail or drew me to that point. And sometimes I have dreams. I've had some really vivid dreams that were clearly things that the Ohio River wanted me to write about. I would be in a dream and just get the sense that the Ohio River was talking to me. That's how I speak to the Ohio River. That's how I hear the Ohio River. She doesn't always speak in English, but she does, I think, show me things. And I don't think that I'm unique. I don't mean to sound like that. I think that there are lots and lots of beings, lots a lot and lots of non-humans who are trying to speak to us, and who would love to speak to us if we sincerely came to them and asked them what they wanted us to know, what they needed from us. And hopefully my book and my project can kind of show my process for learning how to listen.
We only have a few minutes left, and there's a couple things I want to say here. One of them is that I think that the distinction you're making right now is really, really important. And we in the West think that a book comes from ourselves or from our unconscious or from, we make everything up and we get ideas on our own. But so many indigenous people have said to me that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really is. And I think that's one of the reasons this culture is killing the planet, is that we don't perceive the Ohio River as literally having something to say. And so I think you're making a hugely important point. So again, we only have a minute or two, but do you have a response to that? I got a couple more questions I want to ask too, real quick.
I completely agree with you. I think that it's much easier to kill and destroy beings that you've silenced, that you've tricked yourself into believing don't have a voice. Neil Everndon, the great deep ecologist, said that the first thing that scientists do in vivisection labs is cut the vocal cords of the animals they're working on. And the reason they do that is they both affirm that these animals can speak to them, and they also deny their own humanity by silencing those voices. And I think that we do that with rivers. I think we do that with the land. We cut their vocal cords, and when once we cut their vocal cords, we believe that we can do anything to the land, and we don't hear the pain that the natural world is expressing.
And also, life is a lot easier if you don't have to do everything yourself, but you can actually listen and others can tell you some of the things to do.
Absolutely. And there's an enchantment there that there's a whole world that is speaking that we can, if we go to it, just, I mean, just even on a basic level, that enriches your life so much more, that I just think people really need to do it.
Okay, so I have two questions, one of which is off topic and one of which is how can people support you? The one that's kind of off topic is, so when you were standing at the spring and looking at this, did it feel like a baby, like, a tiny little bear or a tiny little tree, or was it a really old being because the spring has been there forever, or is it completely out of that scale?
I love that question. I stood above the spring, and I kind of squatted down and placed my palm on the face of the spring, and almost immediately the kind of images that flooded through my mind was images of the whole length of the Ohio River all the way down, and the length of the Mississippi all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. It felt like I was a bird flying really fast down across the river's face all the way down. And so it seemed like this incredibly old, wise, powerful being that was more complex than I could comprehend. So an old and wise being.
So my last, thank you for that. And my last question is, so how can people support you in this work?
Yeah, I started an online fundraiser through GoFundMe. It's called Help to Amplify the Ohio River's Voice. If you search for that on Google, I'm sure it'll take you to the GoFundMe. Or if you go to GoFundMe and search for that, Help to Amplify the Ohio River's Voice, any contributions would be much appreciated. They'll help me continue to travel with the river and help support me while I write. And any donation will be much appreciated.
And I guess one more question, real fast, which is, so if somebody lives near the Ohio River, what do you want them to do? Just go down and sit and ask the river themselves, or join a local organization, or what?
Yeah, the first thing that people can do is go ask the river and listen sincerely to what the river tells you. I would imagine that the river will tell you that she needs the physical harm that is happening to her to stop. Long term, I want people to organize to physically stop the destruction that's happening, however that needs to happen, whether that's destroying pipes or what. That's what I think needs to happen. I forgot to mention the website, theohioriverspeaks.org. You can contact me through that website. And if there's a part of the river you think I should visit, or if people want to meet up to talk, I've been doing that a couple times. I can meet to talk about the river, learn what you love about the river, learn about the problems in your area, and try to write about it.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, Will, and thank you for all your great work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Will Falk. This is Derek Gentle for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.